When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
True or false? Tuco Salamanca is the first person who dies because of a gunshot in Breaking Bad.
True?
Yes. It's kind of surprising, huh?
Yeah, I had to think about it. I guess the only other two we have seen are Crazy Eight and Emilio.
Yes. And it's not to say that there weren't violent deaths, because obviously Nodos was also killed. But this is the first time we see someone die by a gunshot. And I just thought that was kind of interesting because of the fact that when you think back on Breaking Bad, you think about this as being a shoot 'em up show in a lot of ways, right? There's a lot of violent confrontations because of Walt's decisions. So I thought that was kind of neat that this was the first one.
That is interesting. And you know what that kind of reminds me of? There's this great quote from Alfred Hitchcock. And you know, the movie Psycho, a lot of people talk about that shower scene as being like overtly graphic, where you never actually see like her actually get stabbed. It's implied,
it's
of course.
I thought about that, yeah.
Yeah, but a lot of people remember it as being like one of the most violent scenes on film. And Hitchcock said that, you know, the imagination is able to, I guess, create context way better than like we can actually shoot. So, to your point, I always think of Breaking Bad as a very violent show, and it is a very violent show. What we have seen a lot of violence, but without gun violence already to this point. That is interesting.
Yeah, and one of the things I was thinking in relation to that was the implied violence, you know, because of there is this sense. I mean, in the last episode, we saw Jesse hold on to a gun and he didn't even know how to open up the chamber to change the bullets, you know. Like, these people aren't they're not well versed in how to function in that world that way. And you know, there's so much implied violence that's just baked into things after they make some of these decisions. So one other question: was Tuco in more episodes of Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul?
So he's in Miho. Is it even?
It's actually, he was in 4 episodes of Breaking Bad, 2 last season and 2 this season, and 3 in Better Call Saul. So he was one more episode of Breaking Bad. So it's kind of crazy if you think about it. There's like 62 episodes of Breaking Bad and 63 of Better Call Saul. He's in a total of 7 of those, so that's 5.6% of the entire series. But, you know, his shadow hangs over a lot of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, talk about making an impression, right? To be in such little screen time, all things considered, but to be such an important character.
Absolutely.
He's got a secret ingredient.
What secret ingredient?
Chili powder.
I hate chili powder.
This is Growth Decay Transformation, a Breaking Bad rewatch podcast. I'm Pete.
And I'm Courtney.
And today we'll be talking about Grilled, the second episode of season 2. We get a character and we lose one. We lose one of our first major characters here. Do you think you could possibly give us a nice synopsis of what happens in this episode, Courtney?
I certainly can do that. This was a hard synopsis too, right? Because there's so much that happens in this episode. And what is the whole running time of it? Like 48 minutes? It's incredible how much they were able to pack into just this one. So the teaser is set in the desert, and it features Jesse's ridiculous bouncing car, as his mother calls it, which has clearly been through some things. So there's glass all shot out, and there are spent casings all over the ground, along with a spent body just behind the car. It's a classic Breaking Bad teaser that lets you know that some ish is going to go down. The episode opens on a DEA briefing about Tuco, and Hank pulls Gomi aside and informs him that he'll be needing to take some personal time to help search for Walt, who has gone missing. And back at the White House, Skyler tells Sergeant Tim Roberts, one of Hank's buddies, about the events leading up to Walt's disappearance, including the fact that he received that phone call right before he went missing. Remember when she was in the bathtub and they were trying to talk in the last episode? And there are Hank and, of course, Junior. So Hank walks Roberts out to his car after they finish up, and he tells him that that phone call that she was talking about with Walt never actually happened, which raises the question of the second cell phone, right? And this transitions really beautifully to a shot of Walt's cell phone careening through the air in the desert. And we see Tuco then take out the battery of a second phone, presumably Jesse's, and he discards of that as well. And then he walks up to Jesse's car, pops the trunk, and we find Walt and Jesse in the trunk. He pulls them out. And back in Albuquerque, Skyler and Marie are driving around town, putting up missing posters. Marie tries to use this opportunity to make up with Skyler and again broach the Tierra subject, but Skyler shuts that down. Not the right time, right? And then back in the desert, we get to meet Don Hector Salamanca for the first time, that big character that we meet. Tuco's elderly wheelchair-bound uncle who cannot speak, who he refers to as Tio. So Tuco tells Walt and Jesse that the feds are on to him and they're going to go down to Mexico to cook. And he starts ranting and raving about how Gonzo must have snitched on him. And that makes it clear to Walt and Jesse that Tuco didn't actually kill Gonzo, nor is he even aware that Gonzo is dead. Because if you'll remember, Walt and Jesse think, you know, that he's the one that killed Gonzo. So Jesse tries to get Tuco to take the ricin by telling him it's this new formula of meth, but of course Tuco refuses it as soon as Jesse tells him that the secret ingredient is chili powder. Back at the White House, Marie lets it slip that Walt may have had a second cell phone and suggests that he might have it to get his marijuana or whatever. So Hank then goes to look for Jesse at his parents' house, and his mother, Jesse's mother, shares what kind of car Jesse has, and then Hank follows up with Gomi to ask if he can track it down through the LoJack. Back at Tuco's, news about Gonzo and Nodos comes on the TV as Tuco is in the background cooking. Walt quickly changes the channel, and sitting in the little living room with them is Don Hector. So he checks to see if Don Hector comprehends, and he like waves his hand in front of his face. He starts snapping, and he's satisfied that he's senile. So Walt sits back down, and he and Jesse start strategizing what should they do, and they decide that they're going to try to slip the ricin into Tuco's burrito, which they do as Tuco is tending to Hector. But when Tuco goes to take a bite of his burrito, Don Hector starts ringing his bell madly. So Tuco thinks that Hector wants his burrito and switches plates with him. And then with great effort, Hector manages to sweep the poison food off the table and onto the floor.
I mean, that's the most that we ever see him move while he's in his chair,
yeah,
right?
Up to this point anyway, yeah.
That's what I was thinking, not to interrupt you, but I was just thinking about that, was that when I was watching that, it's like, man, I remembered that he did that, and he moves the water later in Better Call Saul, but this is a, you know, a huge effort on
his
part.
It is. And I mean, up to this point, he seems really catatonic. Like, he's not responsive to any of the stimuli in the room around him. He doesn't look at Walt or Jesse, but he's obviously aware. He's definitely clued in. So Hector keeps ringing his bell quite incessantly as they wait for the cousins to come up from Mexico. And frustrated, Tuco starts yelling at him. But then he realizes that Hector's actually trying to communicate something, and he's able to ascertain that for whatever reason, he does not like Walt and Jesse. So Walt, you know, as he's wont to do, tries to explain things away, and he's trying to be like, oh, well, he must be upset because we changed the channel. He was watching his, and then Jesse's like, yeah, his telenovelas, and we switched it. And that's why he was upset. So Tuco asks Hector for confirmation of this. And when he doesn't get that confirmation from him, he grabs Jesse and goes out front, demanding that Walter tell them what they did, right? And he's got his assault rifle pointed at the back of Jesse's head as he does this. Walt then confesses that they did actually try to poison him. And while Jesse's on his hands and knees in the sand, he finds a rock or something in the sand. And he's able to hit him over the head, and then they start wrestling. Jesse's able to grab Tuco's pistol and shoot him, right? Then they kick him into a ditch, and they run to get into Jesse's car, only to realize that they don't have the keys. Just then, a car comes pulling up in the distance, and Walt and Jesse get on and run because they assume it's the cousins. So Tuco manages to climb out of the ditch, and it's revealed that it's actually Hank who has arrived on scene, having tracked Jesse's car there. Hank gets out of the Jeep, and Tuco grabs the assault rifle that they very stupidly left in Jesse's car, and they exchange fire. Hank manages to shoot him in the head, and as Hank approaches Tuco's body, Walt is able to see Hank, and both he and Jesse flee into the desert unnoticed.
That was a big job you just completed there. That was quite a bit of stuff that happened, like you said. You know, I think what stood out to me for as far as overall impressions was that this is a classic episode. And the stuff at Tuco's hideout and all the stuff you just laid out there is so intense. You know, it's the kind of stuff that I associate with, you know, the classic Breaking Bad episodes where it's just, you know, that they're probably not going to die or any of that. The situation is, you know, it is what it is, but they really manage to make things intense in the best ways. And the teaser sets this up really well because it hints that something terrible is going to happen. And like I said, you don't really know, you don't really think that they're going to die. I mean, there's always the possibility that Jesse could, but you know something really bad is going to happen. And so it's a fun payoff when you find out why the car is sitting there hopping around on its hydraulics. Everything with Tio is fantastic. This is a great new character that even if he only showed up this one time would have been a really memorable part of the story. And, you know, this is one of those episodes that you get so caught up in it and you're just waiting to see what's going to happen, and you're so on the edge of your seat. And then afterward, at least for me, like I'm sitting there going, how's Walt going to possibly get out of this situation? You know, like there's no way. His family's been walking around handing out flyers and everything else. And he's like going off into the desert after being gone for, you know, these last couple of days. Like, how can he possibly explain that? So, yeah, it's a great setup for that. Like, it's just, you know, they do that a million times before the series is over. And it never really gets old for me. And, you know, this is Raymond Cruz's final appearance as Tuco, you know, at least chronologically, since it's the end of his life. And he goes out with a truly memorable performance. So what about you? What was your overall impression?
Very similar to yours, right? This is classic Breaking Bad, and it's a really great action episode that really ratchets up that tension, especially the final scene is just classic Breaking Bad stuff.
Yeah.
I think the whole episode is really beautifully written, shot, and especially acted. I think it's also a perfectly named episode. I mean, all of them are, but this one, it speaks to how, like, the heat is turned up on them, both literally and figuratively, right? So we get the visual of Tuco, the fire in the kitchen as he's cooking the burrito. Also how he's grilling them about why Hector doesn't like them. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, the grill in his mouth, of course, which will come into play later in the series. Mm-hmm. But, you know, rewatching it from my 2023 point of view, having watched Better Call Saul, I think the biggest takeaways for me this time watching it are all of the Better Call Saul connections that this episode sets up, right, that I didn't really notice before going back and rewatching this. So First thing, like in that first opening scene at the DEA briefing, when Hank is talking about Tuco and talking about how like they raided his business and stuff like that and rounded up all his guys, he talks about Dog Paulson, right? And he's going over Tuco's greatest hits, and he talks about this story in 1998 with Tuco and Dog Paulson. And if you'll remember, in Gloves Off and Better Call Saul, there's this scene with Nacho and Mike,
yeah.
And this is when Nacho is trying to get Mike to kill Hector or kill Tuco or whatever it is. And he has that scar that he shows Mike right under his collarbone. And he tells the story about how Tuco killed this guy, Dog Paulson, and part of his skull ended up embedded under Nacho's skin. Now, I remember that very clearly from Better Call Saul, but I didn't remember this scene from Breaking Bad, and I never made the connection before watching this episode this time. So there were a couple of moments like that where I'm like, oh, wow, they do pick up on this again in Better Call Saul. And the attention to detail, I think, is just incredible. And, I mean, some of the stuff's really obvious, right, when you're watching yeah. Better Call Saul that references back, but there are these like little minor details that I guess maybe some of our listeners certainly noticed. I didn't notice this one, and there are a few other ones as well.
Yeah, well, I mentioned that, you know, he knocks the plate off, and then they repeat that again whenever he's first put in, when we learn how he first ended up in the wheelchair because of what Gus did, we see him knock the water off the table. That seems like a direct reference, and...
Yeah, and just to, sorry to interrupt you, Pete, but there's that's something else that also stood out to me. That was from Something Stupid, right? So that says he's recovering from his stroke. So in Better Call Saul, after he has the stroke, he's in the hospital, and what's his name? Gus has brought in this doctor from Johns Hopkins to try to help give him the best treatment possible because Gus doesn't want him to die, mm-hmm. right? And so she's in there doing some stuff with him, and then a nurse comes in. And he's trying to check the nurse out. So he knocks his water off his little yeah. tray. So she'll bend over so he can look down at her butt as she's doing that. And there's also a rhetorical reference, perhaps in this episode of Breaking Bad, because when Walt and Jesse are trying to talk about like why Hector's mad at them, and they're talking about how he changed the channels on his telenovelas, Jesse's like, oh, you know, he needs his honeys. He needs his eye candy, right?
Yeah.
So that sort of is like a fun little reference to maybe something about Hector's personality of, you know, being the ogling type.
Yeah, and whenever you think about the times when you see him prior to being in the wheelchair, that's not really his thing at all, is it? It's the thing that people put on him, you know, because they're trying to figure out what's going through his mind because he can't really communicate. And that's kind of the where they always take it. I think it's the other thing about Tio. I mean, this is, I guess, you know, obviously they didn't really know that he would be a recurring character. So it's really fun to think about the ways that they made him. I kind of, in my notes was saying the Tale of Two Salamancas and how they just were like, okay, well, we got ourselves this guy Tuco. He's really high energy, you know, he's snorting meth, he's could go off at any second. Why don't we make his uncle someone that is completely confined to a wheelchair who mm-hmm. has, you know, who can't speak, he can't do anything, he can't affect the world around him other than to ring this bell. And I think that's a pretty great setup for a new character where, you know, like they have to play off each other. And some of the best dialogue in this, I think, is, you know, Raymond Cruz talking to his uncle because of like when he throws the plate down and he's like, why did you do that? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. it's so funny. And it really wouldn't work in any other way.
You're listening to Growth, Decay, Transformation. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. go to your happy price, Priceline.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Let's get cooking. We're back with more Growth Decay Transformation.
I guess we'll jump into this. There's more about that I want to say, but let's talk about a couple of these other things first. The teaser, this is one of my, like, visually, I think this is one of my favorite teasers. Like, I really like the way that this is put together. The way you see the bullet casings there, the different things out inside the desert that have been left behind. It's sort of, it's a forgotten place where, stuff has happened, but there's nobody there anymore. Nobody but these people who are there at this moment. And we kind of touched on it already about how it works sort of like the teaser of the pilot episode back in season one, right? Where it's just something they show us and then we get to before the episode ends, we get to find out what's going on. And it sets the stage in a really, really great way. I mean, it feels like we're in a completely different place. I know we're still close to Albuquerque, but it feels like, we're somewhere completely foreign. I think that plays a big part of that. And this idea of the car hopping up and down, it really made me think about the fact that this is, Jesse's car. This is the first thing we see, when he takes off, whenever he gets away and Walt watches when his character's first introduced. And it's also its last episode too, right? I mean, this is the end of his, the Captain Mobile or whatever you would call it.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I also really love this cold open. It made me think of a couple of different things. So first, I think it's a really nice bookending effect for Tuco's character. Because if you'll remember when the first time Walt meets Tuco is in A Crazy Handful of Nothing. And when you think of how that episode opens, and that's with Walt walking away from, in the destruction of the building, and he's got like blood or on this bag that he's walking to is his car, and all these people looking alarmed and stuff like that. So again, sort of teasing the final scene in that one. And then again, in this one, you have this tease of violence. And if you think of where we left off in the season premiere last episode, right? Like, we see them get into this car, into Jesse's car with Tuco in the back seat. And it's a very ominous, way to end that episode, very ominous cliffhanger. And then to begin seeing Jesse's car riddled with bullet holes is jarring, right? So you definitely know something bad happens, right? And you see that body behind the car, so you know someone's going to die. But again, I think the first time I watched this, if I can remember that far back, I didn't think it was Jesse or Walt, right? I think I assumed it was going to be Tuco, who ended up dying in that episode. So it was more just seeing that journey of how that came to be, like, how does he end up dying sort of thing?
Yeah, because he has the upper hand, like, so distinctly. Throughout the episode, you're like, how are they going to get out of this? And it, like you said, it's really hard to put that together, like how that's going to play out.
Yeah, but to go back to how they open this, right? So you mentioned that it also kind of like is a little bit like in the pilot, right? Like, we're out in the desert. Nothing ever good ever happens in the desert, right? So like, when we have a scene that opens or a cold open that opens in the desert, something bad's going to happen. But like the way that the camera, it's not a pan, right? But like, as you were saying, like it alights on different objects, like discarded objects. Like, there's a washing machine, like a busted out washing machine. There's a baby rattle, right? So there's these signs of life, but also of decay, right?
Like, yeah,
these
are like this artifacts. Is a forgotten place. They're things that were left behind.
Yeah. And so when I was watching this, I mean, it's a completely different tone, but it made me think a little bit of Better Call Saul, Rock and Hard Place, and how that starts out going through the desert. The cold open to that one is where it lands on the desert bluebell at the end, and then mm-hmm. the shard of glass in the sand. So it made me think a little bit about that and some of like the sound effects that we get. So like the water, the rain in that episode, and it tinkling on the glass, and you don't really know what's happening until the, you know, obviously the final scene of that episode. But here, hearing the sound of the car and not knowing what it is at first until you see the shadow of the car bouncing, yeah. and then you get the reveal that it's Jesse's car, is startling, right? And the hydraulics of it, and the, I guess another thing it made me think of, I'm sorry, I'm just sort of spitballing here, but thinking of like the first time we see like Hank and Gomi out in the field, I think this was in the pilot or the second episode. That's when they recover Crazy Eight's car in the desert, yeah. and they're talking about, Hank says it's a culture in decline, talking about the bouncing car, mm-hmm. this idea of hydraulics. And here again, you get this idea of like erosion and decay. So a culture in decline, in a maybe in a smaller little microcosmic sense of this space, this landscape that is forgotten. I mean, we see this later, this rundown shack. And I was wondering, Pete, is this supposed to be like the same little shack that they revisit, like in Better Call Saul, like where the scene I'm talking about with Nacho, is this the same little house? Do you think? Is it meant to be?
I'm drawing a blank. Like visually, I can't make a connection. I don't know. What was your thought? Do you think so?
I think it might be. I probably should have researched this before we sat down to record. If there's anyone out there listening, who knows, maybe Nutmeg Bites. He knows all the behind the scenes stuff. Is this supposed to be the same place? I don't think it's actually the same location that they necessarily used in Better Call Saul.
That's what I was thinking, that it probably isn't, you know, because I think there would have been a lot made out of that, but maybe the, you know, just from following it pretty closely whenever it was coming out. But I think it may be implied that it is, though. Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's like the Salamanca's place out in the middle of the desert, so.
Like, I have
that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, I have a feeling that this particular place that they used, it's been bulldozed by now or something, right?
Yeah.
Like, it would be crazy if this shack is still out there somewhere and you could still go out and see it, you know. But
I know in Better Call Saul, the location that they used, this little shack that the Salamancas had out in the desert, they called it Murder Valley. That's what like the crew called it.
Yeah Now I'm thinking about that. We're talking about where they take
Nacho.
Yeah, and Mike looks at it through the scope, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely visually different. It, you know, that is in a different setup. Like this place seems like it's on the side of the road, not you know, in a valley or whatever. But that's interesting. I wonder if that's supposed to be implied that way. You know, I want to talk some more about that, but I did want to take a second to. Because, yeah, I mean, this episode really skews towards what happens here inside this place. But a lot of other stuff happens, too. And I just wanted to take a second to go back and talk about... I thought that it was a really interesting line, because Hank is doing his thing. He's at the DEA. He is trying to get people excited to go out and catch Tuco. Whenever he goes out into the hallway, I thought it was an interesting thing where he says... to Gomi that it's all about appearances. Like he really thinks, you know, mm-hmm. there's no way they're going to find this guy. This guy's in Mexico. It's a waste of time, but he still put up the face, you know, in front of his people to try to get them to be excited to go out and look about it. And I thought that was a really nice parallel. It's all about appearances, and the way that Tio is presented, and the way that they, because of the situation, that they have to eventually say, look, this guy is not a threat to us. Like, we just still have to try to get, you know, figure out a way to get out of this and talk to each other whenever Tuco's not around, and just ignore Tio, basically. I thought that was an interesting parallel whenever you're thinking about it's all about appearances. And then it kind of also ties back into this thing of like Walt, you know, I think that one of the most striking images in this, episode is the wanted poster, you know, because it's the happiest that you would ever, this shot of Walt, it's the happiest you would ever see him. Like, I don't think he ever looks this happy throughout the series. You know what I mean? Like, he's got a big smile on his face sitting next to Junior. And it just doesn't really look like him at all, other than the fact that it is Bryan Cranston. Yeah, so I thought that was interesting, because the stuff that happens with the White family as Walt is out there and missing, it almost feels like it's a different show, you know, whenever you think about the way it looks and the way that it feels. And that feels somewhat intentional, because, you know, they would never be able to imagine what's really going on with Walt in that moment, that he's being held at gunpoint in the middle of nowhere, and this guy is about to take him to Mexico to become a cook in a super lab in the jungle. You know what I mean? Like, it.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are a couple of things that I wanted to respond to, if I may, Pete. So the line that you mentioned when Hank and Gomi go out into the hallway to talk, that stood out to me too, right? So, like, it's all about appearances and maintaining appearances. I didn't make the connection to Tio, but I did think of it in a slightly different way. So this idea of maintaining appearances, right, is going to be really important for Walt in the next episode. Like, as you already alluded to this a little bit, like, how is he going to get out of this? And having already watched the show, we know that they devised this whole, you know, plan for how they're going to do that, right? And the fugue state and all that stuff. But the idea of the photograph, I think, is interesting, because what is a photograph? It's just a snapshot. And unless it's a candid photograph catching someone in the moment, it's always all about appearances, right? Like, people smile and say cheese or whatever. But I think it does also speak to what Walt is trying to do. He's trying to keep up appearances that he's just a normal, you know, suburban dad, you know, who cares about his family and stuff like that. I mean, that's certainly the image he's trying to portray. He's pretty awful at it, right? At least to his family, who know that there's something remiss there, but amiss rather. So it is a funny photo that they use to show him. So we have this idea of appearances and disappearances, right? So it's all about appearances, but also disappearances. I thought of it more in those terms, right? So
Well, I mean, that all ties together, though, because, I mean, his disappearance is like I said, what's driving what they're doing. And their perspective is, they're really still at that. I mean, Skyler's a little bit more tuned in, because he has gone he has a lot of unaccounted for hours, because she always was wondering where he's at when he's out cooking or whatever. But, like, everyone else is just worried about him because he has cancer. You know what I mean? Like, that's the frame of reference that they have, is that he was pretty much normal all the way up until he got this diagnosis. And then he started, you know, their image of that, of him had changed. You know, now he's a dying man, and he's, you know, he's got this thing going on, but also, you know, he started to act a little bit weird, but, you know, who wouldn't under those circumstances, right?
Yeah. And they all assume that he must be depressed or something like that. I know that's the big concern, and it's kind of alluded to both by Sergeant Roberts, Hank and Marie talk about it too, and even Skyler and Marie at some point. Like, they're trying to wonder, like, would he harm himself, right? Like, is this something, like, maybe he's giving up on life or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, like, he's already got a great cover story. He has cancer and just the everything that is involved with that. And as he, you know, as he later tells the psychiatrist, you know, who's he's trying to get out of, like, being held or being forced to go see a psychiatrist, like, who wouldn't run in this state, right? So he doesn't really have to do too much work here to keep up that appearance, right? That, like, that it's his behavior is understandable, except for maybe with Skyler, I think, who obviously hopefully knows him better than everyone else, and she knows that something's just not computing, something's not really adding up.
And you mentioned Tim Roberts there quickly. He shows up in Better Call Saul in the fifth season.
Yes, he does. And he's with, is it Gina Khalil, the prosecutor who's looking into Wallow, right? So there's that great scene with the three of them. So it's Tim, Gina, and Jimmy in the hallway.
And he,
the big wall of slip.
He gets the Mike, when Mike breaks into the police, or he doesn't break in, yeah, but he just sort of blends into the police station to drop that folder off. That lands on his desk. And another character that shows up here that will be a background character that recurs is the Mustache Man. I don't know if you know who I'm referring to there. There's a guy.
The Mustache.
Yeah, it's a DA. It's a DA guy. Here he just has like a really full and nicely manicured goatee. But as the series goes on, he has like I don't remember the exact story yet. Like, I didn't look it back up, but I came across this guy because I noticed him because he has like a really impressive mustache. He came back in Better Call Saul. He played a part whenever Hank came back, you know, and it was like, where have I seen that mustache before? Mm-hmm. Because you can't miss it, you know what I mean? And it turns out he popped in. He's a local guy in Albuquerque, and I don't think he ever says anything. He's just sort of there. But yeah, he shows up, and the mustache gets longer because, like, by the time you see him in Better Call Saul, it's like, you know, it's like an award-winning bit of facial hair. So it's something to look into when you watch, you know, when you watch again. Just to circle back a little bit, you talked about we were talking about their impressions and about him being depressed, but I also thought it was interesting how quickly Hank goes to that second phone, how he keys in on that. I guess, you know, as being someone who's in law enforcement, he probably runs into that a lot. You know, a lot of people's secrets involve an affair or something like that on the side. But I thought it was funny when he breaks into the car, he smells the headrest in the passenger seat to see if he can get any clues to the fact that Walt was driving around with somebody else in his car. Did you notice that?
Yeah, I did. And it's funny. I have that in my notes too. And I thought of it as a visual, like, pun that he is right under his nose, literally, like right under his nose. And I thought that maybe he was detecting the smell of meth in the car. But it could have been like he was trying to smell to see if there was like, you know, perfume or
that's
something
what
like
I,
that
that's
in
what
the
I
car.
Assumed,
but
yeah.
But it necessarily wouldn't be that weird. I mean, it could have been Skylar's. I think actually he wasn't smelling. I don't think he was smelling the headrest intentionally. I think he smelled something weird and then he sniffed the headrest. See, I read it very much as like he was catching a whiff of meth. And again, quite literally, right? Walt is right under his nose the whole time. And he's yeah, he's just too blind to it. He can't see it because there's so many inconsistencies with Hank, right? And I mean, it's one of the things that makes his character interesting and compelling, right? And we've already talked a lot about this, like, for example, like how he is so quick to judge Hugo, the janitor, and peg him as like this criminal. Meanwhile, he knows that his own brother-in-law is smoking pot and is like a mastermind when it comes to chemistry. And I was thinking about this earlier,
all the glassware,
right? Like when
came from his,
yeah,
his
exactly
his closet. He's one of the people that has a key to it.
And like he knows at this point with what little evidence that they have, like of the surveillance video of Walt and Jesse stealing the methylamine and the burning the door down with thermite and stuff like that. He even says like these guys have book smarts, right? So he knows that they're dealing with someone that's pretty high level. They know how to do a P2P. Cook, right? Like they're not just relying on pseudo. So like he's just I think it's a combination of both him not being able to see like Walt in that light because he has this idea of who Walt is, and he just would not be able to reconcile this really, like, you know, what he thinks of as like a weak, you know, sort of milquetoast dude, you know, who wouldn't know a criminal if he was close enough to check him for a hernia sort of thing, with who he actually turns out to be. But he's also, we've also spoken a little bit about this, how blinded he is by his own prejudices and his own ideas and his own, I guess you could call it his own, like his own arrogance or his own hubris. Like he has this, he operates under this idea that he already knows everything. And he's like the smartest guy in the room. So like figuring out like that there was the trap in Crazy Eight's car, right? And all these other little things. He's a little in love with himself, I think. Mm-hmm. So he's an interesting character to watch evolve, I think, throughout the series. and how smart he is about certain things, but then how utterly, utterly blind and stupid he is about other things.
Yeah, I mean, he's really human, you know? I mean, whenever you think about the cops, it's annoying because they have undue power, so they, you know, they should have more responsibility. But, I mean, in this context, you know, as DEA agent, you see several times that he's pretty good at his job, for what it's worth, but the human side of him, you know, his personal blind spots are what drive him. So, you know, that with all that extra power that he has and that affords him his position or whatever, you know, it kind of hits a little bit differently. But I mean, at the end of the day, you want a character to be like that. You want them to be flawed in human ways rather than, you know, something that just, you know, works for the plot or whatever.
Well, yeah, the series would be over in 5 minutes if he was able to, you know, figure out who it is. And I mean, like, when he finally does, I mean, it's so poetic that he's sitting on a toilet and he's, you know, reading a book of poetry by Walt Whitman. And that's how he figures it out. And it was Walt's own carelessness, right? And his own attachment to that book that Gail gave him, that he left out very, very foolishly. But that's a conversation for a different day, I guess.
You know, we're talking about smelling, you know, we're talking about what he was smelling there. What does the two words head cheese mean to you?
Head cheese, that's like,
I mean, it means it's a bad smell. Like, I understood that, but I had no idea what head cheese was until I looked it up.
Yeah, well, it's like a type of, like, deli product, right? Like, it's made out of a bunch of, like, gross stuff, like organs.
It's like made
sorry,
out
no
of
offense to anyone that likes it.
Yeah, it's made out of the organs from a pig's head. Mm-hmm. You take all that stuff out, and then you, I guess, you cook it in some way, or you render it in some way, and then, yeah, you get the end product is called head cheese, and I guess it smells really bad.
I can imagine.
Yeah. So, like, is there anything else outside of the end of that we wanted to touch on? Anything between Skylar and she reconciles somewhat with Marie. Is there anything that we need to touch on there?
Well, I think Marie's, like, just how out of touch she is with the situation. And I think it actually adds really nicely to that rant that Skylar had in the previous episode when she's talking to Hank, right? When she's talking about how she's the one that needs support, but no, it's her, you know, her spoiled bitch sister that gets all the attention and stuff like that. And there's Skylar, her husband's missing. This is a very concerning, traumatic event for her, right? And she's worried and she's out putting up posters. And of course, her family is involved. She has, of course, Hank involved on, you know, the legal side of things. And then, of course, she's going to invite her sister to help her look for her husband. But then as Marie is like, okay, so about the Tierra thing, like Marie completely like tries to take advantage of this very vulnerable moment that Skylar's in to kind of like bring up this terrible subject. And so Skylar, of course, shuts it down immediately. But I think this, as I was saying, I think that like feeds really well into the conversation that Skylar had with Hank in helping us to understand just how like really self-centered Marie is and how it's not that necessarily she lacks empathy, but it's like, this really isn't the time, Marie. Like, why would you bring this up right now of all times? Yeah. Who cares about a stupid Tierra?
She's trying to make it about her in a way.
Or, you know, she's like, she misreads the situation. It's like her sister is vulnerable, right? And needs her. And so like, this is like a way to kind of just brush it under the rug and get it or clear the air rather, right? And like I think Skylar lets her know like this is not over and that we're not going to address this right now. And that's something that poor Skylar has to deal with more than one occasion, like people forcing her into conversations or into situations she doesn't want to be in. I think of because the line she's like, not now, or that's a conversation she has later with Ted when he shows up at the house. And Marie is there. I don't know if you remember the scene I'm talking about. He wants to know, like, why she hasn't been returning his phone calls or something like that. And she's like, well, I'm a little busy, you know, not now. And he's like, oh, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, you're going to make me do this right now, sort of thing. So it's a kind of recurring thing for Skylar, poor Skylar.
Take a break. Wander around in a fugue state. We'll be right back.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character Furiosa, starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role and the mighty Thor Chris Hemsworth as the warlord Dr. Dementis. Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com.
All right. Well, I think then we can talk about the way that this all comes to an end for, was it a Monte Carlo that he drives, and for Tuco. And it starts to set things in motion for Hank as well. Things are going to get tricky for him moving forward. A big pivotal scene here. And what do you think is going on, like, visually, when they're shooting this inside this shack, I'm going to call it a shack. Tuco would describe it as a really nice crib in the country. I think shack is a better description. The way it looks like it, I don't know. I'm asking because I couldn't really figure it out when I was looking, but it has sort of a pastel look, the way that the colors are put together. I mean, I know that some of the walls are painted pink, but the lighting, to me, it seemed interesting in this, because this should be a really drab and burnout looking place. But when you look at these scenes, it has this kind of like soft and warm look almost to it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Did you notice that?
Yeah, you get a lot of the natural desert light, right? So, like, I mean, mm-hmm. and I think that sort of speaks to the fact that it's this, like, little place out in the middle of the desert with nothing else around. There are no trees. There are no, like, window. Well, that's not true. They do have some, like, lace curtains, I noticed, mm-hmm. hanging in there, right? So, like, they could blot out the light that way, but it's very sparsely decorated in there. So a lot of the natural light coming in through the windows. Yeah, I did notice.
Yeah, I thought it was a really cool thing. Like the way that it, you know, like I said, I feel like that if you were there in real life, it would be really dingy and kind of creepy. But somehow, you know, this is that. It still sends that message, but there's also something else going on that was a really nice touch, I thought.
Well, it's a nice contrast to the other, like, crack shack we see Spooge's house, right, when Jesse goes to try to get his money back from there, and how
that's
dark.
Like, that looks like a haunted house kind of thing.
That's what I think you think of when you think of a crack shack. That's kind of more or less, like, there's a lot of stuff everywhere. It looks very dirty. It looks like a crack shack. This doesn't look like a crack shack. This looks like an abandoned property, right? And I think the cold open also really serves to support that narrative, that this is an abandoned, sort of forgotten place. And it's just like a hideout in the desert for them to wait at for the cousins to arrive or whatever. Mm-hmm. And if, like, we do think of it as the same place that they had in Better Call Saul, maybe this is what that place looks like, you know, after, you know, several years of neglect or something like that, right? Like, I can imagine it being that same place.
Would you call it a really nice crib in the country?
No, I would not. Definitely not.
I really love the dynamic between. I mean, they kind of mind this again too with his grandmother and Better Call Saul. But I really like the family side of Tuco and the way that he kind of is almost like a kid. You know, like you
what
see
did
the
you
kid
do to
inside.
My tío? Whenever, what did you do to my abuelita?
I thought that was a really nice dimension to the character. But make no mistake, this guy is super dangerous. And you know, we were talking about the windows. Yeah. He's firing the M16 outside of the windows there for a while.
Poor
as
cow.
As he's snorting meth. Not a comfortable place to be. For these two, for Walt. I mean, I like the way that they had the, I'm not sure if it worked 100%, but I like the little thing about them in the trunk. And, whenever they open it up, he thinks he sees Skylar, kind of like an angelic thing of Skylar. And then it's really, Tuco, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of underline the idea of just how uncomfortable this situation is. What do you think of his plan to take them south of the border? I mean, for as deranged as he is, it's not a bad plan. The only problem is that Walt would have to leave his family behind. But
he can get
Tuco
another one.
Out, he get can another get another one.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it is funny, and that does sort of set up, like, right, so you kind of alluded to this family dynamic that Tuco has with Hector, with his abuela, and of course the Salamanca, like, family motto is la familia es todo, family is everything, and this is something that Hector seems to instill in all of the nephews, right, so the cousins from Mexico, when he tries to drown one of them, you know, to teach that lesson, certainly Lalo also. But at the same time, like, these are crazy violent people, right? And so it's mm-hmm. sort of at odds, right? So like that Tuco, it's just, I think it speaks to his psychopathy, right? So, like, family is everything to him, but he can't seem to conceive that Walt wouldn't want to leave his family, right? Like, who cares? Just get another family. So you know, it is an interesting little disconnect, and I think that's might speak to not just his psychopathy, but also to the effect of the meth that he takes. When he takes a bump, he goes nuts, right? And he starts shooting cows, or he wants to clean out the manure between Jesse's ears and put a bullet through him, like he's a cow or something, you know? Yeah. And, you know what, watching, Raymond Cruz in this episode, made me think of, I know we've talked a little bit about, the Coen brothers, previously on this podcast, but have you ever seen O Brother, Where Art Thou? with George Clooney and John Turturro. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you remember the scene where they're with Babyface Nelson, and they're in the car and they're like trying to escape the cops that are chasing them. And he's got his like what are they called, those like old timey guns. There's a
Tommy
name for
gun?
It. Tommy gun. Yeah, he's got a Tommy gun, and they're driving through like some like pasture or whatever, and he sees cows and he's like, cows, I hate cows, and then he just completely shoots. Obliterates a cow. It's very much like Tuco in this. I don't know. It just made me think of it. And I wouldn't be surprised if it was a little bit of a nod to the Coens.
Yeah. I mean, I think as many Vince Gilligan interviews that I've listened to, I mean, he name drops the Coen brothers quite a bit. So yeah, anytime I see something that vaguely looks like it might be related to their work, I think it probably is, you know, if not directly, then subconsciously, because he's obviously, you know, paid a lot of attention and enjoyed the stuff that they made. We talked about family, and it is funny, right? Because Walt, that's Walt's default, you know, I'm doing this for my family. The Salamancas, they say, you know, yeah, we do all this terrible stuff, but it's all about our family. It's kind of interesting when you think about it, you know, family's the one thing you can't really choose. I mean, I guess they're talking about blood. Whereas Walt's talking about the family that he married into, which is slightly different. You
well,
know,
Junior and his pregnant wife is carrying his child. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, that's his blood.
Yeah, yeah. No, I would agree. I'm just saying that, you know, it's all just a coping mechanism to, you know, to be able to do what they do. You know, they have this thing to say, but yeah, I'm doing it all for this higher purpose, for this pure thing. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah. I get what you're saying. So it's like their moral touchstone, right? Right. Like, so
yeah.
If they think of it in terms of like, this is for the family, then that makes everything that they do justifiable. But of course, I think the parallel that you're making here between them is that it's the same, right? Like, it's not true in either case. It's not really true for Walt any more than it is for the Salamancas.
Yeah, it's just their thing that they can go back to. And you know, we're talking about, you know, the family, the Salamanca family. What would you think of if I said that Tuco was the one that got away?
Tuco was the one who got away.
Mm-hmm.
In what regard? Like, what sense?
Well, I would just say that there's this guy that we haven't met yet, but he'll be a big part of the series later, Gus Fring. All of the other Salamancas that die in this series, he has a direct hand in what happens to them. Tuco's the one that got away. As far as we can tell, I mean, he's not on the radar at all, obviously, when they wrote this, but there was no way for them to even kind of say that he had an influence here. Tuco gets taken out. It's the one Salamanca that we see die that, you know, is all to leave. You know, Gus's plan obviously is to leave Hector all alone and miserable at the end, take away everything from him, from his family, because of what he took away from Gus, which was Max, right?
Yeah, and I guess even because I was thinking about the two cousins, and I guess even in a regard, he's kind of responsible for that too, because he sends Hank, you know, or warns Hank so that he's able to kill one of them.
Yeah, and then he directly kills the other one.
Yeah, he has Mike go in there and dispatch him. There are other Salamancas that we never get to meet or really know about. And I've always been so curious. I know like a lot of fans would love like a Salamanca like spinoff or more backstory or something like that. But like for example, like Gonzo is Tuco's brother-in-law. So does that mean Tuco has a sister somewhere, right? That was married to Gonzo? Like, and how is he his brother-in-law? Of course there's the Abuelita. We don't know who, like, so Hector is everyone's uncle, right? He's Lalo's uncle. He's Tuco's uncle. He's the twins from Mexico's uncle. But they're all cousins, right? So like, who are their parents? Who are the other like Salamanca brothers? Like, who are Tio's siblings? Like Hector's siblings? That family tree is so interesting. I'm curious to know more.
Just on a purely statistical level, I mean, if you have that many male cousins, there's certainly a couple of females, right? You know what I mean? Like,
there
has to be there has to be women in the family, but you never actually to see any of them except for Abuelita.
And Hector has children, or had at least one child at some point, because when Gus and Jesse take out Don Eladio and everyone in Mexico,
they take out his grandson.
They take out his grandson, thing, right? Because he comes back and he gloats about that, about how they were able to get his grandson, all of the people connected to that side of the family and the cartel, right? So it is interesting, to your point, though, like the only one that maybe Gus doesn't have a direct hand in killing, at least that we're aware of, is Tuco. Maybe also Abuelita, I don't know. Maybe just old age got her. I don't know.
Yeah, because I think, not to give Gus too much credit or whatever, I feel like he would leave the women out of it.
I will kill your wife. I will kill your son. I will kill your infant daughter. I think he'd kill women too.
I think he would, but I think in this particular showdown with Hector, it's more about dominating his role in the just because that's the way that they came together, was through the cartel, and the way that they sort of jockey for power, and he wants to take out that whole system, that whole structure. So, you know, in that sense, if they weren't like the kind of ladies that might step in and take over the family business, and they certainly are never referenced in that way that I can think of. You know what I mean? Like, even whenever Lalo's fleeing back to Mexico, you know, he says, well, Tuco's getting out in 11 months. Or, you know, so there's room for them to introduce them, but they never do. So I guess we can just have, that'll be my headcanon anyways, is that the women are not involved with the drug business in the Salamanca family.
Or maybe they're just not involved with the Salamancas anymore. They're just kind of like, you know, breeding stock, because there are no women in their lives. I mean, I think, you know, at the briefing.
That is kind of funny.
Yeah, at the briefing, Hank mentions that Tuco had like a meth, like hag of a girlfriend or something like that. So you get a sense that it wasn't like a real relationship or anything like that. Hector obviously doesn't have any, like, a wife that comes and visits him or cares for him. Or anything like that. So La Familia is Toro. It's like the only family that really seems to matter are those that help further his business interests, right?
Yeah. So another thing that pops up here in this situation is that everybody is quick to just off Jesse Pinkman whenever I mean, Tuco, like, they just want to waste him because of just of his just being there. Like, he's just annoying. You know, you get the sense that he just annoys people by being. Is that, do you think that's a fair statement?
Poor Jesse. I mean, he already has a history with Tuco, right? He beat up pretty badly the first time they ever met, right? So
Tuco pushes him onto the ground every time he sees him, at least once, it seems like. You know what I mean? Like,
he does.
Grabs him by the neck and throws him into
the
dirt.
Junkyard. Yeah. Jesse gets beat up a lot.
He does. And, you know, there's this shot of him going through the door here after, you know, Tio keeps ringing the bell. And then, you know, finally Tuco puts two and two together that these guys are up to no good.
They're punking him. Yeah.
Yeah. There's this shot of him going through the door, and you kind of see the door get ripped off the hinges. And this is Aaron Paul doing his own stunt. And, it turns out that he knocked himself out here and got he passes out and had to go to the hospital, had a concussion, the whole nine yards. And, you know, I was reading about this, and they were saying that, and it's totally believable, obviously, because Raymond Cruz is an imposing figure. That, you know, the way I read it was that Raymond Cruz got so into the scene that he threw Jesse through the door and knocked him out and everything else. But
that's not actually the case.
Yeah. When you listen to the Insider podcast, Vince Gilligan makes he says pretty directly that Raymond Cruz was worried about something like that happening and that he didn't know how to do it. So he asked Aaron Paul, how do you think we should play this? And Aaron Paul said, hey, you know what? The shots from outside, I can just throw myself through the door because no one's going to see it anyways. And knowing all that stuff, you know, like reading those things and then going back and watching it is absolutely brutal. Like, his body, like, hits the ground in a way that is just disgusting. Yeah. You know that.
And something else that they mentioned on that podcast that I didn't know until listening to it, Vince is telling the story exactly as Peach has described it, right? So it's not that Raymond Cruz actually threw Aaron Paul out the door. Aaron Paul threw himself through the door. But the door was not like a prop door. That was a real screen door that he knocked off its hinges, right? So
it jumps off the hinges.
Yeah.
Like I said, I maybe I watched it a little bit closer than anyone should or whatever. But yeah, it jumps off the thing. I mean, like that is it's an impressive thing that Aaron Paul was. He sacrificed his body for that in a way that, you know, wow.
Yeah, he definitely did, poor guy. But it's a great shot, you know. It's very effective.
Yeah, and you know, like I was looking at the whole thing, and you know, he's there, and it does make a big difference. You know, the fact that you can see his face, and that it's like when he throws him against the wall, like the wooden thing that's outside there, and everything else, like you can see his face in the thing, and I kind of feel like that. That's something that's going by the wayside, like that you probably don't see the big actors in series doing that as much. I mean, I'm sure they want to, but I feel like that's just bad business in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like these are pretty physical scenes, but I mean, I'm glad they did it the way they did it because it came off. I feel really bad that he got knocked out and had the concussion.
Something that Vince apparently was on set for when they shot the final scene, where there's that confrontation with Jesse and Tuco. And he speaks about how just absolutely terrifying and how like emotionally raw that whole scene is as Jesse's pleading for his life, like, please, I don't want to die.
Yeah.
And something they talked about on the Insider podcast is just how phenomenal the acting really is there. When it's you know, something like Aaron Paul or Raymond Cruz and the wonderful acting that they're able to do, but also the silent acting that you get from Mark Margolis, who plays Tio Hector. And I think it's some of like and you mentioned a little bit about this when you were talking about the two Salamancas, like you have the really like outgoing, over-the-top Tuco, and then the very quiet, reserved Tio, and that's a nice contrast there. But we get other silent characters throughout the series, so certainly the cousins, who never really say anything, mm-hmm. I think maybe utter, like, maybe five words in both series altogether.
They're like a direct combination of both sides of that. They're quiet, like Uncle Tio, or Tio.
Uncle and Tio, yeah.
They're explosively violent like Tuco. They got both of those things wrapped up in one package there.
They're so scary. But also, Gus has a certain quiet thing about him as well. So certainly, I mean, he talks. This is a character that speaks a lot. But yeah. I think some of the scariest scenes with Gus are the ones where he doesn't say anything. So there's a lot of this really great silent acting that goes on in both series. It really helps to, again, sort of ratchet up that tension. And it's because you want them to talk. You're like, say something, right? And it really helps you feel the tension that the characters feel. So I'm thinking of in Breaking Bad, when they're down in the super lab right after Gale has died and Gus comes down and, you know, Mike has been tasked with killing both of them sort of thing. But now they're waiting to see what's going to happen now that they don't have a cook. And just how that Gus doesn't say anything until, like, you know, after he goes back up, after he, like, dispatches poor little Victor. So it's the silent acting, I think, is really great. And I think this episode in particular really establishes that. This is with the introduction of Tio and some of those silent moments. And then we'll see again with the cousins coming up pretty soon.
Yeah, and talking about the acting, I mean, the scene you pointed out, or the part that you pointed out with Aaron Paul there, where he's begging for his life. He's saying, "I don't want to die." He's not really begging. I guess that would be a little bit off. But the three of them there, all three of them working in that super tense situation. I don't know what, I guess the rhythm of it, or like the way that they play off each other, like it's, you know, the way that it's cut, everything is like, is pretty superb right there. And, you know, there's just like a little bit of stuff that, that Bryan Cranston does there in response to what Tuco's doing that set up that big line that he delivers there. You know what I mean? And it's just like so much stuff is happening in those few moments. Like, I mean, I think like if you think about the actual time they go outside till the time when he gets hit in the head with the rock, I mean, you're not talking about a lot of actual screen time, but it feels like a lifetime, you know, like because so many things transpire like in those characters' heads in those moments, as you know, he really is at the edge of his life. I mean, there's you know, Jesse Pinkman should have died there if things didn't play out the way they did, right?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, really, and Walt saves his life, right? I mean,
yeah,
on multiple occasions, but definitely here he intercedes and saves him.
What do you think about the choice of let him bleed?
I think that's a classic film character mistake, right? Like you certainly see it in horror movies. Like never assume they're dead. So, yeah.
It's one of those screaming at the screen kind of thing. Like, no, don't do that. Don't walk away. Just shoot him. You both have guns trained on him right now. He was going to kill you. You know, you can definitely justify this later on in your head. Just take the headshot there, right?
Yeah, no half measures, right? Like they didn't finish the job. I mean, it works out for them. Ultimately, in the end, I guess. But yeah, it's definitely one of those moments where you scream at the TV, like, what are you doing? No, don't walk away. And then when they think the cousins are pulling up and they leave I keep wanting to call it a machine gun, but the rifle, they leave the rifle in the car when they get out to run. I was like, no, what are you doing? And of course, that's the gun that Tuco pulls out when Hank pulls up. Mm-hmm. So.
As far as they go, I mean, a pretty good last stand for Tuco, I think. This is something we've seen before time and time again, and the reason is because it works, you know. I did like the spin that they put on it, you know, that he hits the hydraulics, so, you know, the car is going there. Because, like you said, just to really go back for a second, you know, you were talking about, when we were talking about the teaser, you were talking about that sound. The sound design there is fantastic, you know, because you don't really, it's a sound that you know, but it's not mm-hmm. something that you're like, oh yeah, that's the car bouncing on its hydraulics. Like you need the visual to put those two things together, right? Not for me. Maybe you spent a lot of time around lowriders and you know, you're that's yeah, a sound that's you're more familiar with. But like
I read that the hydraulics at the end was designed to sound like a heartbeat, and then yeah, like, the car finally is that where you were going?
Yeah, that's where I was very slowly getting to. I was having trouble making it there, so thanks for the assist on that.
Yeah. But
yeah. I thought that was a great character thing, you know, that the car is, that sound comes back in after he hits the button that we already, you know, made that connection with in the beginning. And then, you know, they said that they set it up so it was beating fast because of the adrenaline of the moment. And then it, you know, it slows down to where he actually expires next to the car. And yeah, like I said, I think as far as last stands, it's pretty memorable. It's a pretty good one.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is a good first like villain death, I guess, and the villain deaths. Like I think I made this analogy previously. It's like if you think of Breaking Bad as a video game and how like the villains get like bigger and tougher, you know, mm-hmm. like this is the first round maybe, or second round if you think of Crazy Eight and Emilio as like the first round. That's like the very first villain you have to fight, and then Tuco is like the big villain, but then coming up we have Gus, right? So the deaths are going to get more explosive and crazy as they go along. So yeah, this is I think a satisfying ending for this particular character.
And you know, Hank, it shows that he can perform under fire, right? I mean, this is a harrowing experience for him. The guy is firing off a lot of bullets in his direction. His car.
Yeah, but can he really handle it?
He did here. As far as
I mean,
we
yeah,
know.
he I mean, he is able to take the effective kill shot and everything like that. But I certainly got the sense that this is like the first real shootout Hank has ever been involved in, right? So, he talks a big talk and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, we'll see, like, what after, you know, he goes down to Texas and how he copes with the trauma of this sort of violence, right? And we see him, this might be a little bit of foreshadowing of what's to come with his PTSD that he gets from this confrontation with his own mortality sort of thing. Yeah. We see him get into the elevator at the DEA by himself. And, of course, later on when he has his PTSD, that's kind of like his moment, like the descent, like literally a descent going down into an elevator. But also it's where he has his like little private moments where he starts to hyperventilate. He starts having panic attacks and things like that. That happened, the elevator shot I'm referring to happened before he even went out into the desert and had this confrontation with Tuco. It's right when he's leaving the DEA offices and he's worried about Walt, right?
Yeah.
And trying to find Walt.
And I think it's heavily implied. I mean, the grill, it's called grilled. Like you pointed out all those other different connections that are there with that title. But the grill itself, you know, he gets that later. And I think that's all. It's been a while since I watched those episodes. But I mean, I think that is a reminder. That's something that plays a big part in his downfall. That's why when I was talking about it earlier, I thought, you know, this sets off his journey in that direction. You know, this is definitely.
I think this is the first time he's really been in this kind of situation. So you think of like the last episode where they come upon the crime scene with Gonzo and with Nodos, and he's cracking jokes. Look at old Stumpy here. And, you know, it's all hilarious to him, and he's got this real gallows sense of humor about it.
He said it in this episode too. He said, if you want to see that, they're on my website. Like he put the photos up on some kind of website.
Yeah. So like, you know, it's either in the next episode or sometime in the near future. I don't exactly remember which one it's coming up in, but when they gift him Tuco's grill encased in like the plastic block or whatever. Mm-hmm. Again, like that seems to be like very much in line with his sense of humor and his sensibilities and all the disgusting, you know, jokes he makes with his DEA buddies, right? Like, so it is something that seems like it would appeal to him, but he's horrified by it, and he eventually gets rid of it. He throws it into like a river or something that we then see later at some point. But this is the beginning of a shift for him. So of course he's going to be hailed as a hero for this and everything, but at this point we don't know it, of course, because we just see what happens, and he's able to effectively neutralize the threat and everything like that. But I don't think it's what he expected it to be. So, but he's going to still have to, as he tells Gomi, keep up appearances, right? So he's going to have to try as much as possible to mask how much this affects him.
You're listening to Growth Decay Transformation. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Let's get cooking. We're back with more Growth Decay Transformation. One other thing I wanted to touch on, and then we could probably wrap up this part, is the bell. I think this is such a great device as far as, you know, the way that it's an affirmative, you know what I mean? We're like, we kind of work our way through it here that, you know, when he's saying, what did they do to you, T.O., did they do this? And you don't really understand how it works, the bell. You know, we just know that he's hitting it, making a noise or something. And then you realize it's an affirmative. It's a way for him to if someone says the right thing, then he can say, yes, that's what I mean, or whatever, you know. And I liked how that all played out within the episode, because at first he's just this guy who's sitting over there with his annoying little bell. You know what I mean? Like, why are you ringing that bell, dude? What's going on with that? You know, and then eventually you see that that's literally the only way that he can communicate. And I think that's such a good idea. You know, they later on in Better Call Saul, they'll explain how he got it.
Yeah, and Vederson, that's when Lalo goes to see him right after his stroke, and he brings him this little gift. And for those that don't remember, he tells he reminds Hector of the story of how we don't obviously get all the details, right? And I love, just a little side note here, but I love Nacho's face in that scene, because Nacho is with him with Lalo when they go to see Hector in the nursing home. And so, like, Nacho has no idea what he's talking about, but Lalo's laughing, like, do you remember this time in whatever town they were in Mexico, where there was, like, some professor that, like, was into, like, antiques and stuff like that, who had, like, old books and other, like, artifacts that they killed, and they burned down his place. And then Lalo confesses to Hector that he later went back to the place, and he was able to retrieve this little bell as a souvenir. And that's how Tuco gets this sort of antiquated bell that Lalo then straps to his wheelchair for him. It's so gruesome. But I love that they included that detail in Better Call Saul, and they give you all this backstory. I love it.
When I was researching this episode, I was, you know, one of the things that popped up was that the bell and the grill in the block of resin or whatever it is, those were two of the high ticket items in you know, as far as like props that they auctioned off at different times. Which would you rather have, the bell or the grill?
Definitely the bell.
Yeah.
What about you?
I think you'd have to go with that. I mean, it's just such a I mean, you wouldn't want to ring it that much, I guess, you know what I mean, because you're gonna pay a lot of money for it, and it's you know, it's a thing, but just to be able to ring it every once in a while, you can't really put the grill on, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I have the next best thing. I have a Hector bobblehead in his little wheelchair, and his bell actually works when you ring the bell.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah. And another thing, well, about the bell, just quickly, when I was reading about this, apparently when he's in the shack with Tuco and Walt and Jesse, when he's ringing the bell incessantly, trying to get, you know, Tuco's attention, he's actually ringing it out in terms of SOS, right? Like, he's trying to send the signal the way that you would, like, an SOS signal or something. But Tuco, I guess, didn't pick up on that. I didn't notice it either until I read it, but maybe people out there are a little bit more tuned into that, caught it. But I thought that was a really, really cool little detail. I love learning, like, reading about the episode and like all this behind the scenes stuff. And I'm like, oh, that's so cool. And just a couple of other things. Like, if you're interested in this sort of behind the scenes stuff, you should definitely check out the Insider podcast. They don't really talk about like themes or anything like that. They really just talk about the behind the scenes stuff that goes on. But they talked a little bit about some of like the editing that went into this episode, because on this episode it was Kelly Dixon, who's an editor, who's also the host of the Insider podcast, Vince Gilligan, and then the editor of this episode, Skip McDonald, thank you.
Yeah.
And they talk about like how like they did the muzzle flash, they talk about the gun and the prop and some of the issues with the gun there. How like they had to invert or mirror one of the images of Tuco and then like digitally move his teardrop tattoo. It's just some cool stuff if you're into it.
Yeah, I really enjoy that. I was really happy when we got to season two so that we could start to listen to that before we made this, because that was such a big thing in the Better Call Saul days, was to hear what they had to say, because they have so many interesting details. And I mean, like, you know, for me, it, you know, I'll probably never get, this is probably the closest I'll get to a TV production, you know what I mean? I'm never going to find myself on set or something like that to see any of this stuff in real life or whatever. So it's fun to hear them talk about it and get a different perspective, because there's so many moving parts, you know what I mean? Like when you think about, you know, of course we criticize a lot about how things turn out on television, you know, but when you think about all of them, and you should, I'm not saying that there's any, you know, it's not like you have to give them a break when it doesn't work or something like that, but it's amazing how many moving parts, how many people are involved to make all of that stuff work when it does actually work. And you know, I like to learn as much as I can about that.
I do too. I love it. I love all the behind the scenes stuff. All right, so should we move on to favorite line, favorite shot, or is there anything else you think?
I'm ready to go. I could go first this time. Just because I know that yours is, I actually saw your favorite line in the notes before I picked mine, so I know yours is one that's probably I might have picked if I hadn't seen it. You picked it, you know.
Well,
what I mean?
You know, I think I changed my mind. I if you look at the notes, you may have seen I added. I can't ever decide. You know.
Yeah, it's difficult. But for me, this one was not difficult, actually, because I wanted to do one with Tuco since it's his last episode. He says at one point, he says, "They're out there looking for me right now. They got ghetto birds and black ops." And the ghetto birds, like, that was so random to me that I really loved that. It's a great way to show this guy, this paranoid guy, that he I think. As far as we know, I mean, he's the first person that ever tried the blue meth, and we don't ever see Jesse sample it anyways on screen. I don't think so. You know what I mean? So, like, as far as we know, he's the first person that tested the blue meth.
Well, isn't it like the same thing as the meth that they were making when they were using like pseudo? I mean, the only difference is the processing. I mean. Because the white stuff, I'm sorry to interrupt you here, but like because the stuff that they find and they sample that Hank finds in Crazy 8's car, that's like the purest stuff they've ever found before. And that's not blue yet. I mean, the blue is just like the novelty or the signature of it. So, but yeah, you might be right, at least in terms of on screen, like who tries the blue version of it first.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That the that's what he's remembered for. That becomes his brand. You know what I mean? The P2P blue stuff. And I think he's the first one. And you're right. I mean, I'm sure if you get into those high numbers that they're doing, that all meth that is that strong would have a similar effect or whatever. But yeah, I just thought that was something that is interesting that he was the first one to try that out.
I wouldn't be able to speak to the difference between meth made with a pseudo versus a P2P cook. But maybe if anyone out there knows the difference, if there is a difference between the two, I was going to say maybe write in, but maybe don't write in. Don't
incriminate yourself.
Yeah, don't put it into
writing. We're not judging, you know what I mean? Like, you know, whatever, but maybe don't put that to paper or whatever. What about you? What was your favorite line? You said you changed.
Yeah, I mean, so the line that Walt delivers, of course, when he tells, finally confesses to Tuco that, yes, we tried to poison you because you're insane. You're an insane, degenerate piece of filth and you deserve to die. I mean, it's such a great condemnation. But, you know, upon second thought, like, that seems like the obvious choice, right? Because it is such a powerfully delivered line. But One of the things that stood out to me in this episode that we haven't really talked about it is, well, you did a little bit talking about like the humor in this episode. You spoke a little bit about Raymond Cruz's humor and how he plays with Tuco and or with I keep calling Tio. I meant how like those two play off of each other. But there are a couple of other lines that really stood out to me. when Tuco is telling Walt and Jesse that like he thinks that Gonzo snitched on him, and Jesse's like, "Yeah, I'd waste him too, yo." And then Tuco's like, "Shut up," you know.
Yeah.
But I think probably my favorite line, again, it's going to be Walt, and he says, "You know, my life's not the priority here because I'm going to be soon dead anyway." Right when they're trying to discuss what to do, yeah. And Jesse's trying to convince Walt that he should just like sacrifice himself and throw himself at Tuco, you know. So, and then Jesse's response to that is like, yeah." I thought that was really, really funny. Given the situation, so yeah. I appreciated the levity again in those really dark moments, and there is a lot of humor in that entire scene between those four characters.
Yeah, just to go back to the big one that you mentioned first, that you're you're an insane, degenerate piece of filth and you deserve to die. I like that one because you have where Walt is right now, like in his journey. You have where he ends up later. You have the way that he sees himself, the way that other people see himself, like all these different things about this central character. And like he's not wrong. Tuco no. is insane.
He's not wrong.
He's filth, and he probably does deserve to die as much as someone can deserve to die. And Walt later embodies all those things himself. You know what I mean? So
yeah, he does.
That was an interesting connection.
It reminded me a little bit. Sorry, this line also reminded me a little bit of Nacho's final monologue in Better Call Saul when he's talking about like how glad he is that Lalo died and he wished that he had done it himself. And it's not the exact same language, but he calls him like a pig and
it's the same sentiment though.
Yeah, the Salamancas definitely inspire disgust and hatred in everyone that they seem to encounter. And they have a point, right? It's deservedly so.
they're not nice people. They're not
no,
nice
they're
people.
Not.
As far as shots, I really like, there's this, it's not very long, but there's this really intense sequence where Tuco grabs Walt by the ears, basically, I think, or maybe by the neck. He's holding him by the head and he's asking him if he can trust him. And the way that it sort of cuts to a couple different scenes, but there's one that's like a wider shot, and you see Tio between them, like in the little gap between their body, like you see him sitting in his chair, and you were talking about like the silent acting and everything else, and he looks so checked out, like there's this crazy violence going on and he's just sort of like sitting there, and I thought that was a great setup, because it really does, it's kind of in the background, you're not really, it's not the most important thing that's happening there. Mm-hmm. but it furthers this idea that he's this he's just this human being that's obviously not a threat, he's almost like furniture in the room or something like that, in the way that they set that shot up. So I really like that.
Yeah, so I have a hard time, as you all know, with picking my favorites. I guess from like a philosophical point of view, tend to reject like trying to like talk about what is my favorite whatever, favorite film, favorite book, because mm-hmm. how do you really do that. So there are a couple of things that always stand out to me, right? And probably the first thing when I watched this was, you already mentioned it earlier, Pete. It's when Tuco first opens the trunk, and we see this image of Skylar from like where the point of view is from like within the trunk, looking up and out, and she's like kind of like cast in this like angelic light. She looks like she's got like the halo around her, and she says, "I forgive you." Her hair is kind of flowing. Mm-hmm. She kind of looks like a Botticelli or something, or even biblical in a sense. And I was thinking of also something that I never noticed before rewatching it this time is that Jesse has a little Virgin Mary hanging in his car from the rear view underneath his dice. Yeah. I thought that was interesting. So you have these sort of like the merciful mother, you know, looking over them sort of thing. So that stood out to me. And also because it's not something that we typically see in Breaking Bad, that kind of like hallucination or visual. And I thought it was really interesting. I was trying to figure out like what was the choice here? Why would they show Skyler when they open the trunk? And I guess it was a way of just like reiterating that we're seeing things from Walt's point of view, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing that we see when the trunk is opened, instead of seeing the two men in the trunk or seeing Tuco outside of the trunk or something like that. Like, why aren't we seeing Jesse's point of view or Tuco's point of view? So we're still very much entrenched in Walt's story and Walt's narrative. And even though like this really sort of broadens out and you see a lot more story, but of the characters and so on and so forth. But I thought it was just like an interesting choice. Like, why did they decide to show Skyler at that moment? But mm-hmm. like you, there were a lot of other smaller moments, especially in the shack. I think a lot of that silent acting, I really love like how Walt and Jesse constantly mirror each other. Like when they're sitting at the table and they almost look like they're in prayer position. They have their hands folded like over their mouths.
Yeah.
And when I think if I had to really say like what is my favorite shot, like that just I love this moment. It's a shot of Jesse. And it's right after Tuco switches his plate with Hector's, because he thinks Hector wants the bigger burrito. And Jesse's eyes, he just does this like his expression is of horror, right? And so like you can read that in a couple different ways. And I think it's actually a really interesting look at Jesse's character and how Jesse thinks and feels and stuff like that. So obviously they want Tuco to take the ricin. They keep trying to get him to take the ricin and they keep failing, you know?
Yeah.
This is like the second or third attempt, right? To get him to take it. But also I think like Jesse's horror that like they would inadvertently kill an old man, right?
Yeah.
Like it's, I think that's also read in his expression. And to be able to do that silently, right? To both show like, you know, like, oh shit, Tuco's not taking the rice in, but also, oh fuck, we're about to kill this old man. I don't know if other people read Jesse's face that way in that moment, but it's really just great facial acting from Aaron Paul in that scene. I love that shot of him.
Yeah, I did pick up on that, or at least I pondered that when I watched it this time. I'm not sure that ever stood out to me before, but that's cool that you pointed that out, because I thought the same thing. Do you think they ever ate those burritos?
Tuco, I think, had a bite, right?
Yeah, I'm saying specifically Walt and Jesse. Do you think they ate theirs after everything settled down, or maybe I'm forgetting how that came to a close, but
well, they cut, right? So they cut. Yeah. So after Hector manages to sweep it off the table, right? Then it cuts to them watching TV, and
so there's some time there. They could have eaten it.
They probably did. I mean,
100% Tuco goes back to finish his, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, 100%. And I think because Tuco wants them to eat it, they probably ate.
You would eat it, right? I mean, it looked pretty good.
Yeah, you know, as awful as the Salamancas are, everything they cook looks really good.
Yeah,
right. Those burritos look really good. Lalo's
tacos,
four pepper salsa looked really good. Have you seen that video? What's it called? Breaking Kitchen on YouTube. That guy edited, so it looks like they're in Gordon Ramsay's kitchen. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I never saw that one.
Oh, you have to watch it. I'm gonna send you a link to it. It's so funny. Anyone else out there listening that doesn't know what I'm talking about, go to YouTube, type in Breaking Kitchen. It's so funny. I don't want to say anything else about it. Just go check it out.
All right. Well, I think we can probably bring it to a close. Is there anything else you wanted to add before we do that?
Nope. I think once
we get into the burrito discourse, it's probably time to move on.
Time to wrap it up like a burrito.
Yeah, of course. All right. So if you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow our podcast and set yourself up for notifications. Please rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. That would definitely help us out. We're trying to grow. It's not the most current thing, but we have a lot of fun doing this, and we would enjoy it even more if we could get more people to listen to it.
Yeah, and share it, right? Like, if you enjoy it, if you don't mind, share our podcasts on your socials, tell your friends about it. Anything you can do to help, you know, elevate the podcast helps us and allows us to continue to keep making these episodes.
Yes. And if you want to support us directly, you can. You can join us on Patreon. You can find us there at patreon.com, Growth Decay Transformation. And you can follow us on Twitter, where you can find out whatever we're up to and interact with us there. And why not write to us at breakingbadgdt@gmail.com. Send us your feedback. Let us know what you want to hear in future episodes, what you're looking forward to in the series, and whatever else is going on with your rewatch. We don't always get the chance to respond to those, but we love to read them, and they definitely are something that help us decide where everything is as far as how people are receiving the podcast.
Yeah, and you can find our producer Talitha's Instagram at Talitha_makes_things. So thanks for listening, and join us next week when we'll be discussing season 2, episode 3, Bit by a Dead Bee.
That's really the name of the next episode?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I feel like that's the first time I ever heard that. So that's
exciting. A film reference. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. We'll see you next week.